Welcome, dear listeners, once again to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squepakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squepmik people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our best, our very best, to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, there's an old aphorism that most of us have heard at one time or another. It's, look before you leap. Translated into everyday experience, the meaning of this is to make sure that when you take a step in your life, you have some idea where it's taking you. Our guest today is somebody who has done a lot of thinking about taking care that when the world of science meets the world of public policy, in particular when it comes to food, a great deal of thought needs to go into ensuring that we humans don't take steps that seem good at the time, but end up being counterproductive. This is especially true in a world where change and the need for change is everywhere. The current actions of humanity are leading us straight towards big problems: a growing climate crisis, widespread pollution, overconsumption of the planet's gifts, and a rapid loss of other life forms, as well as increasingly dramatic inequality between haves and have-nots. So any solutions we devise need to be carefully thought through. Dr. Navin Ramakuti is a professor at the University of British Columbia and for 4 years, director of the Institute for Resources, Environment and Sustainability, known as IRIS. And he spent years and the last decade and a half in particular researching and thinking about how to grow enough food for humankind while avoiding causing even more harm to the planetary ecosystem. Navin, I'm delighted to welcome you to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren. It's great to join you. And I would also like to acknowledge that I'm joining you from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people.
We're finally starting to admit that our Indigenous forebears, and really, in human terms, our cousins, have a lot to tell us and a lot to say. And we'll be talking about that later on in the show. Now, before the show, we asked guests for information about their own background, and you were very thoughtful in your comments. And I wanted to start with something very human about you, and it's nothing to do with food, and that's swimming. You've just taken up swimming, and if I'm not mistaken, some of that swimming is in the ocean. But at the very least, swimming, what moved you to say, it's about time I took up swimming in my life?
No, it's not yet in the ocean, a correction.
That will come one day.
I'm hoping, I dream of that. I'm 54, and I have two children who love to swim. And there were a couple of moments when I think I realized my lack of swimming is an issue, both for myself, more broadly. So I once went with my kids to the ocean when they were swimming, and I was the accompanying adult, and it struck me that something happened. I wouldn't be able to do anything.
You just drown.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I decided to start swim lessons. It was also something that gave me some meaning in my life, I guess. Yes, I'm going through a midlife crisis. I'm in my 50s.
Well, this is a good way to handle it. Yeah, go jump indeed. The lake.
Yeah. So I've been taking swimming lessons for the last 2 years, and it's become one of my favorite things to do.
Are you developing a sense of swimming, I wouldn't say mastery necessarily, but a feeling of comfort in the water? You know what to do now.
Yeah, I do. And I'm still only doing it in the swimming pool, but I'm not afraid of the deep anymore.
Yes. Well, I grew up swimming in the ocean in the summer, and it was one of my most enjoyable experiences. The water has unique qualities that is different from the air. You need a little oxygen when you're under the surface, but other than that. Now, you also used a word when we were talking before, in the last day or two. The word's serendipity, and as Tom Grady, who's my engineer, knows, I use the word often because it seems to be a guiding principle in human experience. So I thought it would be interesting for listeners to hear about the long and winding road that you've been on in getting to the place where you're at now. The director of this institute, which obviously has huge currency for today, resources, the Institute of Resources, Environment, Sustainability. But you started a long way away in Coimbatore, which is a city in the most southern province of India, Tamil Nadu, which I worked out is about a third of the Earth's circumference distant from where we are speaking today and where you are located right today. And this is a very unusual city in terms of India. It's got some unique qualities. I quoted from Wikipedia, regularly features among the top 10 best cities to live in India, and is amongst the top 3 safest cities in India. There are parts of India in the north that are not always safe, but Coimbatore is not like that. And it's also one of 12 cities in Tamil Nadu that has been selected to be a smart city by the Indian government. What's it like to have grown up in a city like this? You spent your first 2 decades in that part of the world. What was that like? Did you know this was an unusual city that you were living in?
I must admit, no. And I still don't have. It's my home, but I don't have a lot of fondness for the city itself.
Yeah.
For the reasons. I mean, it was my family is from Kerala. That's about an hour away from Coimbatore.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And my parents moved our family to Coimbatore because, as you say, it's a bigger city, and Coimbatore has better schools and better educational institutions.
But so Kerala itself is a wonderful place. I mean, it's known around the world as the most progressive state, not just in India, but on the world's landscape. It's a marvelous place, and your grandmother was there. And what was your connection with your grandmother and this landscape of your heart, as you called
it? So when we were kids, my parents would drop us off in Kerala for the summer, so we spent 2 months every year wandering around the landscapes of Kerala. My grandmother lived in our house is still there, lived in a small village surrounded by paddy fields and mountains. The landscape of this region is on either side of the Western Ghats.
Yes.
My grandmother's village was in a pass in the Western.
The Western Ghats are mountains for listeners.
Yeah. So we were surrounded by beautiful landscapes, and that's in some ways where my heart was growing up. I just looked forward to the beginning of the summer. I sleep the night before, and I have memories of waking up early in the morning. My dad always insisted on taking the 5 o'clock bus to Kerala.
Get up, we're off.
And
that shaped you, hasn't it?
I do think so, I believe so. Whenever I go back to India, I always make a point of going to Kerala again.
Yeah.
I still have some cousins there, but I just love going back to my old, my grandmother's village.
Now, your brother, you mentioned, he's 10 years older than you, and he embarked on his professional career was engineering. And your parents had this, which many parents with a certain ambition for their children, they often say, well, let's not fool around here. Let's go for the social prestige jugular. And so that would mean, in your case, I think it meant either an engineer or a doctor. You had
correct.
Any choice you wanted to make as long as they were engineer or doctor.
Yeah. we are a family of 3 sons. I'm the youngest of 3. And my dad, in his mind, had laid out that one of us would be an engineer, one would be a doctor, and the third would go into civil service.
So what did your third brother do? You initially went into engineering. What did your other brother do?
He went into management, essentially, yeah.
Well, I suppose that's kind of a private version of civil service, you might say.
Maybe, yeah.
So engineering was where you started, and you got your first degree in Coimbatore, in engineering. But somewhere pretty early on, you realized that wasn't... that wasn't your passion, that didn't speak to you. I can't imagine how you would when these 2 months in the summer were the high point of your childhood. It was going off to be in this lush landscape of the Western Ghats and your grandmother's village. It must have implanted itself in you.
Yeah, indeed. And coming back to the question you asked about growing up in the city, you know, the city didn't speak to me in the same way.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was dusty, polluted. I didn't cherish that as much. So I think that was part of my psyche. I recall also being involved in organizations that were about cleaning up the city.
You already knew that there was.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. The other thing is that you ended up in Vancouver, and Vancouver is aspiring to be the greenest city in North America, if not the world, which is a little bit over the top. But did that have an influence on you in your decision eventually to move to this part of this country?
No, not really.
It was more the academic.
It was academic and personal as well. My parents-in-law live close to here.
Yeah. Well, that's another reason why people make a lot of decisions. And speaking of family matters, your brother, somewhere along this line, sent you a book on climate issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that caught your attention. How did that happen? How did that change things for you?
Yeah, so it was towards the end of my engineering degree. And as I said earlier, I kind of knew that wasn't quite what I wanted to do. I wasn't passionate about it. I was doing well. I got good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother had offered, my brother was already in the United States. And he had offered that, we were a lower middle class family at that time. And he had offered that he would pay for 10 grad school applications. He thought I should come do my graduate degree in the United States.
Mm.
I didn't quite know what I was getting into, but following what he told me. So I applied to 10 engineering schools. During that time, I was reading this book about climate change. And something triggered me, and I thought, this is interesting. So I asked my brother if he could pay for 3 more schools in atmospheric sciences.
Mm. That was the sort of connection that you made with the atmosphere and that part of the ecosystem.
That's correct, yeah. That's a serendipity, right? So I did not get into a single engineering school, but I was admitted to 2 schools in atmospheric science.
And the one you ended up was the University of Illinois in Chicago. I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Naaman Raman Kuti, who is a professor at the University of British Columbia and for the last 4 years, director of the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability. So in addition to a switch in academic pursuit, there was also a big switch in culture. You arrived in a large, very large urban center in the United States of America. And what was that like?
Yeah, so the university was in Champaign-Urbana, which is south of Chicago.
Outside, yep.
Yeah, so it was, miles and miles of cornfields. it was a complete culture shock. It was the first time I was living away from my parents. In India, you tend to live with your parents.
For sure.
As long as
and increasingly in Canada, I might add.
And increasingly, in Vancouver, especially.
Mm-hmm.
It was a culture shock living by myself and getting used to North American ways of being.
What was the most? What were the most? Some of the most shocking things that you've? I mean, the most things that were different from what you were used to in India.
I think the first was learning to cook.
Yes, your mother was your cook up to that point. Yes, I suspect.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as a male growing up in India, you're not really in the kitchen very much.
It's a wonderful skill to have. I mean,
it is indeed,
the practical side of food.
Indeed. And now I love cooking now, and I cook fairly often in my in my household. So,
you've been warped by North American culture. We're happy to say
that's one of the good things.
Yes, indeed, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. The other is in Indian there are a lot of Indian culturisms that I had to good things I would say. Indians tend to speak over each other and not wait and listen. Maybe because we are large families and the only way to get a word in is to
a common, constant tumult of conversation.
Right.
Yes, indeed. Well, you've learned very well. We're having a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. Now, you were studying atmospheric science. That was your entree into sort of environmental issues. But there was still a sense, I understand from you, that it wasn't really, you weren't quite there yet. You talked about even having a bit of imposter syndrome, like not feeling this was the right place for you. Why don't you talk about that and why it wasn't the right place for you?
Yeah, so, there's what you care about, the passion you have for thinking about the climate problem, and then the tools and methods and the skills you need to develop to work on that, right? And so I realized as I was taking coursework in atmospheric sciences that it was a bit too abstract for me. So there's a lot of abstract and mathematical thinking about how the atmospheric system worked. And while I struggled by, and again, I think I did okay, grades-wise, I realized it wasn't my strength. And it was also more abstract than, you spent a lot of time thinking about things that happened, high in the atmosphere.
The 20,000-foot view.
The 20,000-foot view, and you're not really looking down at the ground.
And then you had a supervisor who was a challenging person to deal with.
Indeed.
I think the word you used was harsh. And you did your best to get some good things out of that relationship. But what was that like, having somebody who was intense and was driving you and demanding? How did that play into what you were doing?
Yeah, so that was the other kind of shocking part of, moving to the United States to start a degree and then suddenly having a supervisor who worked you hard. He had us working day and night. He himself set a good model of staying late, but, he had this idea that graduate students, you get a research stipend, and then you do your coursework and your research. And he always said, you during the day, you're working on your research, not can't do coursework. Can do your homework. And so we worked till the end of the day doing your research, and then at night was when you did all your homework.
And then you cooked your food and then you tried to sleep.
That's right. Oh. Yeah. So regular days of 2 in the morning, going home at 2 in the morning, and we also worked weekends.
And you found out something interesting about him long after sort of things would be done, that You found out that one of the reasons he had a particular reason for driving you hard, that there was something about the relationship with you, that he, if he liked people, he pushed them.
I think he cared. I think he cared deeply about, he was a good traditional classical scientist, but he was a particular personality as well. He and I did get along. He cared about me. He, did good things for me. He wrote good letters of recommendation. He sent me to conferences. There was a lot of things I'm really, really grateful for him. My first two publications were in a top-ranked journal. I'm a co-author with him, but those were stepping stones for where I am today. And I will not be, even though he was harsh, I'm only grateful for the background he gave me. Yeah.
Sure. Well, there's nothing like learning how to work hard as a skill, as a mental skill.
Indeed.
But this still wasn't, you didn't feel this was the right place in terms of what you were learning. It wasn't the right place for you. And you switched. And why don't you talk about that switch and how that came about?
I'll have to use your favorite word again, serendipity.
Hooray. Hooray for the serendipitists.
Yeah. So I was in the library, I had decided to do a PhD with my, in the same department with my PhD supervisor. We had to do a comprehensive exam for the PhD, and I failed it the first time I took it. And so that gave me pause, and I thought, okay, maybe I'll look for other things. And so I was in the library leafing through a newsletter from my professional organization, and there was an advertisement for a PhD fellowship at the University of Wisconsin. And the title was Fellowship in Climate, People, and Environment Program.
And that caught, when you were telling me about that, caught my attention too. My goodness, we're getting somewhere now.
Indeed. All in a title.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So you did it.
I did it. Yes. Yeah, I contacted the person who had posted that advertisement. He asked me to come visit, and he's become my long-term colleague, mentor, and friend. Yeah. Mm.
So that was a really auspicious switch. And where did your studies lead you? I mean, you didn't abandon some of the expertise you'd gained already, but what did you branch out into at that point?
I initially came with the idea of during my PhD day, and this is what I really loved as well, is I switched my ideas around. My PhD supervisor gave me a lot of freedom to explore different ideas and try different things out. So I initially came with the idea of studying the impacts of climate change on people, the Climate, People, and Environment Program, right? During multiple conversations with them, began to realize that climate is not the only way that people change the planet, that we transform the landscape through things like deforestation, right? That those were not as well studied as people had studied climate change on a planetary scale. Of course, Indeed. People are studying deforestation in particular places, but not on a very large planet.
And food came in there somehow. Food snuck in. I mean, you, the budding chef, cooking for yourself, had transformed your own life. How did food creep into this process you were engaged in?
Yeah, the food creeped in a little bit later, which is, so I spent my formative PhD years studying this landscape transformation, right? We've cleared all this land for human use. What is the primary human use? It turns out it's agriculture. It's croplands and grazing lands. Right. And then I started thinking, wow, we are transforming a third of our world's land surface for growing food. So I started thinking about food and food security as an important issue. Yeah.
You looked at, and eventually you looked at land use change over a period of several hundred years, which I always think, looking at the lessons of history is the way we correct our own behavior today. And this, I can't remember which one of us used the word, but this tsunami of European settlers who descended upon the so-called New World, that's what they called it.
Right.
It wasn't new to the indigenous people, but it was new to them. And the transformation was and has been absolutely dramatic.
Indeed. This is something we forget, right? These days we talk a lot about tropical deforestation, but we forget that deforestation in this part of the world happened at even faster rates back in the 1800s.
Yes.
And so there is a lot of injustice in telling Brazil and Indonesia that they should stop their deforestation when indeed we did it many years ago, hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, we're often that way. The European capacity for hubris, we have all the answers, is almost limitless. It's a sad thing. So
hubris mixed with hypocrisy.
Yeah, not a great mix.
No,
kind of a bad combination. So you did your thesis. Your thesis examiner, that was a really good experience for you, this process of having that person work with you on that. Then what happened after that? Your next step was University of Wisconsin in the middle of all this. What happened then? You had many moves. I got to make sure I get them right. And you're the better person to get them right.
So I finished my PhD at Wisconsin, and I looked for jobs in many different places. I got offers from several parts of the US and Europe. But I was having a really jolly good time working with my PhD supervisor, who also offered me the option of staying back and working with him as a research scientist. So I stayed for six more years at the University of Wisconsin, worked as a research scientist. So essentially, it was not a professor job, but it was only doing research.
And how did you shape your research in those 6 years? It was obviously formative for you.
Yeah, so that's when I started moving into this food security area. So my PhD was all about land use change. And then the following 6 years, I started moving into looking at agriculture and the environmental trade-offs.
When you worked through that, what kind of conclusions were you drawing? What were you seeing as relevant?
Yeah, so the most important thing at that time was purely descriptive, because I think in the environmental sciences, the focus at that time was on climate change as the big problem. And I'm not saying that it is not. It is still a huge problem. But there wasn't as much focus on the other environmental problems. My PhD supervisor uses the term "the other inconvenient truth," referring to the movie about climate change, that there are other inconvenient truths, and our food system is one of them. Our food system is actually transforming the planet on a large scale, leading to issues of things like biodiversity loss, water use. Agriculture is the biggest user of water, water pollution, and so on. And so on a planetary scale, we need to be thinking about solving multiple problems at the same time, which is a big challenge.
You, at some point, decided you were going to cross the 49th parallel into Canada. What led to that decision? What was there at McGill that was enticing enough to bring you across into Canada?
First, I married a Canadian.
Well, that'll do it every time. Every time. Dear, they say if you want to learn a language, fall in love with somebody who speaks that language. So there you were.
Yeah, so I met my wife at the University of Wisconsin. She grew up in Edmonton.
That's very Canadian.
So when I had options of moving to Canada, she was excited about it. So we moved together, yeah.
You said, all right, I'll do this for you, but maybe for all of us. Just to remind listeners, once again, I'm speaking with Navin Ramkuti, who is a professor at UBC and director of the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability. So, led by love and affection, you crossed the border. Why McGill? What was it about McGill, which is a long way from Edmonton? Why was it McGill? What was it about it? I know there's McDonald College.
Yes. As an academic, you often have to go where the jobs take you, right? So you can't really pick and choose. But McGill was our dream job in many ways. I had two options. I had at that time, I could have gone to the University of Colorado or to McGill. They're both really good universities. Let me say we really loved Montreal as well. I spent, we moved there, spent 8 years there.
Indeed.
I was initially a little, talking earlier about Kerala, I was initially a little nervous about moving to a large city like Montreal, but the city really grew on us.
And what were you doing there? What was your focus while you were in Montreal? Obviously, your thinking is evolving. Serendipity is at work constantly, and there were serendipitous events, I'm sure, that led you in different directions. What were you channeling your energies into?
Yeah, so that was my first job as a professor at a university, I had the good fortune of having lots of great students. Initially, my focus there was on sort of looking at agriculture and environmental trade-offs. I do remember one another serendipitous moment which shifted some of my research since then, which came from one of my PhD students who was taking one of my classes. And as part of her class project, decided to examine the question of whether organic agriculture is better for the environment than conventional agriculture. And got some interesting results from that project. And we thought, oh, we should look into this more. And it eventually became her PhD project. So that was my shift to doing more research, looking at alternative forms of agriculture. So until then, my focus was just on the conventional agricultural side. And, you know, I still do that. How can we make conventional agriculture better for the environment? But I also switched to looking at examining other forms of agriculture, comparing them to conventional.
We're going to get into some of the papers you've written and the ones that have really been seminal with respect to some of these ideas. But clearly, I sense, as just listening to you and talking to you before, that there's this movement towards... The thing about food is it's essential. We can argue about all sorts of aspects of food, but we cannot deny the fact that, you know, if you're really overweight, you can go for 60 days without eating before you die. And you can only go for 4 minutes without oxygen and maybe 3 or 4 days without water. But eventually, we all have to eat. What was it that somewhere along the line, you were also doing a kind of a global survey. You were looking at the big picture of the whole planet. And that actually ended up with you winning an award in Finland, the Wahuri International Prize in 2020. But what was it that made you broaden your scope and look at the whole landscape, not just local landscapes, but the entire global landforms?
Yeah, part of it was my training, my original previous training in climate sciences, right? So during my master's degree, I was looking at climate change. I was looking at global. How does the world planet's climate changing, and using global models and working with those kind of global tools. So in some ways, I was bringing that same perspective and same sets of tools to looking at the land. Now there are lots and lots of people doing it, but at that time, there weren't a lot of people looking at the land in the same global way. And so it was a new contribution to the literature. And it was also a perspective that, you know, a lot of us, it's in science, it's good to have both a detailed local view of the world, because that's where you solve problems. But it's also sometimes good to have a 10,000 foot view. To be able to see, you know, my God, what are we doing?
Yes. No, and I think that is really a valuable shift in thinking, which a lot of people are undergoing right now. Thinking, okay, I'm growing food or I'm living my life in this one area, but what impact is what I do having on the rest of the world? In order to know that, you have to know what the rest of the world is about. And that kind of internationalism and thinking internationally is becoming very much harder to avoid doing.
Indeed.
A lot of people just didn't think about it, right?
Yeah. A very good recent example is what's happened, which are changing relationship with the United States, right? Suddenly, Canadians have realized, oh, we've been so dependent on the U.S. for our fruits and vegetables.
Yes, indeed. And for many other things, and for them buying our products. And suddenly, the administration in the United States has got some wildly different ideas.
Indeed.
So you were having a good time in Montreal. You were acclimated to a large urban center, although McDonald College has quite a spread of land.
I was on the downtown campus.
Oh, you were. You didn't. Yeah. Did you ever get out to McDonald College?
I did. Yes.
We lived in Montreal for 7 years, and McDonald College was like I didn't go to McDonald College, but I did go out there once, and I knew where it was and what it looked like, and it looked like a bit of a haven of rural landscape in the middle of a large urban center. You then moved in 2014 to British Columbia, to the University of British Columbia. What steps led to that? Because at that point you had two young daughters, which is, you know, moving is a different matter when you have two young children. Yes.
Yeah, my daughters at that time, they were 2 and 5, and my parents-in-law, moved to they were in Edmonton. They retired. They moved to BC, to Vancouver Island, and so we were making these long flights, from Montreal to BC and back. And then at some point we thought it'll be, and they were also getting older. So my wife thought it'll be nice to be closer to them. My mother-in-law had cancer at some point, and with a lot of angst for us to be
for
far
sure,
away.
For sure.
And so then there was a job opportunity at UBC that came up, and we thought, we should try this out. And again, we were very well settled in Montreal. We were happy with our jobs in McGill. There was nothing pushing us out of there, but this opportunity came up. Again, maybe you can call it serendipity, but it was a great fit for us professionally.
What was it about the job at UBC that resonated with you? This transition when you went to University of Wisconsin and you broadened your scope, and the work you're doing in the academic environment was very much more flexible as you got going and broadened your scope. What was it about UBC's, what particular things about UBC's job, call it a job, were really attractive to you?
Yeah, first it was a job that was framed around issues of global food security and environmental issues. It was framed exactly in kind of area.
That's my job, you said.
Indeed. so it seemed like a great fit. I had visited UBC 2 years before to give a seminar and met some colleagues here and realized, this is a great place. Disciplinarily, it was also better fit. At McGill, I was in a geography department. I loved my colleagues, but geography was, it's a great discipline, but it was not my discipline that I had been trained in.
Right.
Whereas here in at UBC, I'm in an environmental sciences program, which is a better environment and sustainability. It's a better fit for me.
Sure.
So there were, but honestly, I wasn't thinking about it as a professional. I was looking at it as a lateral move, not as a move up the ladder.
Yes.
We were moving laterally with a job that was equally good, and we get to stay closer to our grandparents, to the kids' grandparents.
Which is that wonderful process of taking a number of currents in one's life that appear to be disparate. They appear to be separate, but they're actually all together in one's own consciousness. They all play in the idea that somehow you simply pursue a work-related goal or a personal life-related goal. The best decisions usually are ones that involve multiple levels of decision-making. Mm-hmm. Now, before you left McGill, there's a paper that you wrote, that you and 20 other co-authors, which was published in Nature, and I thought we could talk a little bit about some of these ideas in more detail. And the abstract, it's called Solutions for a Cultivated Planet, and it clearly, all the things we've been talking about, the massive changes in land use, were coupled with other things. For example, you talked about population, human population, for example, in that paper, and about consumption, themes that have come up later and become even more important. And you also, in this paper, the collaborative group that you were part of, talked about the fact that a billion people at that time, and mostly still now, are chronically malnourished. Now, that's to do with food, but it's also to do with social justice and the maldistribution of food. Lots of people have said, we have enough food, we just don't, spread it around very nicely. And then you started talking about these other issues: water use, degrading the land, biodiversity loss, climate changes, and started to propose some solutions. So the solutions were growing food production, but shrinking the footprint, the environmental footprint of agriculture. And you actually said the word dramatically, shrink it dramatically. What was the theme that you were getting at, this large group of collaborative authors. What were you trying to say? And by the way, this article had 130,000 readings. It was accessed 130,000 times in Nature, which is a big journal, but obviously you struck a responsive chord. Both, what was it? Because you identified the problem or because you started talking about solutions?
I ask myself that question a lot, and other colleagues ask me what was it about this paper, and I think it was the first. All the solutions we discussed in that paper were not really new. Like, it wasn't dramatically new solutions that people hadn't thought about before, but we in that paper was the first time we tried to do a global assessment of how much each of them matters. And so, you know, it was the first paper where we put all four or five different solutions together into one consistent analysis. And the other part of that paper is that it's the first one that I think says we can't do it with any one of these, that we have to have a multi-pronged strategy to solve this global problem.
And you mentioned that earlier about how scientists get involved with doing local work, working on a local issue or a narrow subject, but thinking broadly demands a different kind of approach. And one of them, one element of that is multidisciplinary. The co-authors in this paper were a wide range of people from multiple backgrounds. And it seems to me that was also an important feature in this paper. A lot of people sitting down and putting some thoughts together on paper from a lot of different angles.
Indeed, that's become the norm in my field, to know that we can't do it alone. You know, of all my publications published over my career, I have only a single paper that's single authored. Everything else is a collaborative work.
I noticed that, and I noticed a trend, and I think it's a wonderful trend. It's indeed getting away from, you know, what do they talk about, silo, you know, living in a silo.
Indeed.
Well, this silo I'm sharing with Dr. Navin Ramakudi, who's a professor at UBC and director of the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability. Now, we're going to go straight from that large collaborative paper to one that you actually did write yourself, and it was a couple of years ago. Yeah. And it's a paper that seems to me to sum up a lot of the things that we've been talking about and that have become important to you over time. It's got a broad scope. The title of this paper is Both Technological Innovations and Cultural Change Are Key to the Sustainability Transition. And it seems to me that that's bringing together two often widely separated areas of human endeavor that really are linked, but linked not because they're always studied in the same forum, but because they really are like moving out to BC because your parents-in-law were here and your mother-in-law was unwell, but also because there was a job here and you could study the matters you were interested in. So you mentioned things. I'll just go some of the things in that paper and you can maybe illuminate them somewhat. First of all, you mentioned the Anthropocene, the age that is now recognized as a time when human activity has shaped planet Earth as the most important impact on planetary functions. That's a word that I guess you must hear and say a lot these days, or at least it's in the background of a lot of the work that you and your colleagues are doing at UBC.
Indeed. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, humans, I think one of my colleagues call it a challenge of our imagination, that traditionally we never imagined that we could alter the planet on a planetary scale, right? And we are still, a lot of people who don't believe in climate change or who don't believe that humans are having, you know, global environmental outcomes, possibly are challenged by that.
Exactly. It's something like always we saw Mother Nature as sort of self-contained and managing her affairs, and we could just take advantage of the parts we liked and she would carry on. But now we're having to accept that we have made, well, what we have done, and one of the sentences right after that is, human influence on the Earth system has greatly exceeded the safe operating space across multiple indicators. And that's something that is also very hard for people to understand, that we've made things, some things worse. You know, we've caused things to degrade and deteriorate.
Yeah. I mean, and that the cost of other species and cost of Mother Nature, right? That we as a species have become so powerful a force, you know, bigger, more powerful than some of the geological forces. And we are doing it at a pace that's faster than Mother Nature can adapt.
Far faster. What was the old thing, the three C's? Cows, chainsaws, and caterpillars, the caterpillar tractor, have done this rapid change. It's astonishing how fast it's been.
Yeah.
And agriculture has played a central role and is, for people to understand, it has been the greatest source of biodiversity loss of any factor that's playing on the planet these days. So we get food at the expense of all the life forms that we aren't getting food from.
Indeed.
That's what that boils down to.
Indeed.
Then you go on to talk about this, and I think it's a very interesting point because there's a lot of talk about, you know, we just have to have more high-tech solutions. We can do things with technology that will make the food supply grow. And the people who deny climate change and deny our impact on the planet say, oh, don't worry, we'll come up with a technology that will solve the problem and everything will be fine. And your point here is that the Green Revolution, which was a technological revolution and a high input, you know, lots and lots of water, lots of fertilizer, lots of specially designed seeds, that was going to solve the problem. But you make the point that that's not enough. And then you use this other C word, consumption. Why don't you talk about the uneasy marriage between technology and increased consumption? There's some problems there.
Indeed, and it's a issue of, I would say, short-term thinking versus long-term thinking, right? And so the this is not to deny, again, as the title of the paper says, that their technology has to play a role because we are in a sort of a short-term crisis, right?
Yes.
We have extreme weather around the world that are harming people, especially the poor or disadvantaged. And we need technologies to try to solve some of those problems, including like shifting to renewable energies and all kinds of other things, right? Mm. New green infrastructure, grids, and all of that.
And you point out that if we had cleaner, greener sources of energy, it could, if we don't change our cultural notions, encourage us to grow more food and take over more land and expand things at the further expense of Mother Nature.
Exactly. So this is the problem if you focus on only one problem at that time. If you focus on just solving the climate problem without thinking about the fact that we are, you know, having an impact on the planet in multiple ways, other ways, the other inconvenient truth, then you can solve one problem and create another.
Indeed. And you use the term or the phrase fiddling at the margins. You know, we do this, we do that, but we don't really address the fundamental problem. And the
That's
fundamental
right.
problem is our relationship with planet Earth, in a way.
Indeed. And so in the long term, we need to start thinking about changing our relationship to planet Earth. And this is, I mean, we discussed another example the other day, which was we have a history of solving one problem and creating another. And the classic one is of automobiles at some point were seen as a solution, right? To
thank you. The horse poop story.
The horse poop story. So, you know, when during the days of horse carriages, the stories of how New York City, streets in New York City were filled with horse poop and it was a big problem. And automobiles suddenly came along and lo and behold, they didn't leave any visible residue, right?
What a wonderful thing. Clean up the streets of New York.
Indeed.
With air quality issues as well.
Yeah.
In your paper, you also talk quite eloquently about turning to our indigenous friends and neighbors, the people who for so long, not in India and in Canada and all over the world, the people who actually are responsible for caring for more as a disparate community, for more land than anybody else. But they have been neglected and ignored, and yet they, and you're quite clear about this, that they offer us insights that can help us in this cultural shift, can help us with some important things like taking responsibilities, like only taking as much in the way of food as we need rather than as much as we can get. Why don't you talk about that? Because that's a new flavor in not just yours, but many other people's thinking.
Yes. I mean, and it is not my thinking either. I'm bringing attention to, you know, something other people have talked a lot about as well. It's that in the long term, we need to change our relationship to nature. And if we don't, we'll continue to solve one problem and creating another.
Indeed.
And the indigenous people have, I mean, and the most important thing they have to give us, I think, is the values, the way they connect, the way they relate to the land. And it's a relationship of reciprocity. It's a relationship of giving more than you take. Our current culture is all about taking as much as you can get.
Yes.
So unless we change that, I think we are going to keep creating problems into perpetuity. Yeah.
Do you sense that transition in thinking towards celebrating and exploring and amplifying those values that characterize indigenous cultures? Do you see that there's a trend? I mean, UBC is a large institution. It's got lots of things going on. Sometimes the left hand talking about, you know, creating a problem by solving another. The left hand doesn't always know what the right hand is doing in a large institution like a big university. Do you see any patterns or trends there that give you a sense that there is movement, towards wiser conceptions of our relationship with the earth?
I mean, I do think there is movement. There's a growing movement. The challenge is that there's a growing counter movement as well. And so I think this is the, you know, challenge of humanity, is that we have these cultural wars right now everywhere in the world, I would say, of, you know, people who are highlighting these voices that are so important, but people who are resistant to that.
Well, you've compelled me to, as we're nearing the end of the show, to quote one of your countrymen who I think everybody knows about and who is respected universally, and that is Mahatma Gandhi, or Mohandas Gandhi, as he was known as a real name, who said he had this four-part pattern in human culture. First, the powers that be ignore you. They first ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Would you care to comment on your countryman's observation? We're in a certain sense, we're in the fight stage.
Yeah.
We're in the stage of massive resistance from the old paradigm.
Yeah. I wish that we celebrated more people like Gandhi these days. The sad thing is that even in India, people are besmirching him.
Yes.
But I mean, he was known as the half-naked fakir who brought the United Kingdom to its knees, right?
I know, it's lovely.
I really wish we had leaders like that these days.
Yeah.
I wish we had leaders who inspired us to be better parts of ourselves.
Well, Suzanne, what's her name?
Simard.
Yes, Suzanne Simard. Thank you very much. I brought the Indian person. You brought the Canadian person. Has said that her conversations with indigenous peoples have pointed out their opinion, which is that the changes now are not taking place at the leadership level, they're taking place at the grassroots level. They're taking place in citizen advocacy and more low-level, if you like, which we consider low level, but it isn't really. It's a substantive change in culture and consciousness that the leaders, both political and corporate and even sometimes scientific, haven't quite grasped yet. The change is taking place underneath their feet, as it were. Do you sense anything like that happening? I mean, hearing conversations, hearing young people, your students, etc.?
I think it's a question of power, ultimately, right?
Yes.
And even if there are leaders who have sensed this, I think there are lots of great leaders out there at the grassroots level. But to get to a position of power, it's very challenging. And these days, with the enormous inequality in the world, you know, the billionaires are pouring billions of dollars into making sure that the leaders they want are in power. And so this is the challenge of our times, is how do we fight against the billions of dollars that are going into costs?
So maybe we're all going to have to find our inner leader somehow and bring that forward. And I think that's maybe a form of serendipity that is more global, that we all have to take on this responsibility. Navin, it's been wonderful, honestly. We're at the end of the show. It's been wonderful having you here. And at some point, I have a feeling we might have you back to talk more about some of these really seminal issues of our time. Thank you very much for spending time with us today. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
It's my delight, Warren. Thanks for having me.